And it's really been, it's been very reinforcing to hear scholars talk about this at the conference, because what it's done is it is has reaffirmed that some of the things that I discovered in my own amateurish way aligns well with what I'm hearing scholars say. That higher ed, as I see it, really was not a leading institution in this neoliberal urge. It really has been a following institution. So with things that really picked up steam in the 1980s, it took a while, I think, for higher education to become as neoliberal as some of the other institutions, at least I would submit. And it's gotten to the point now when they say, okay, we're in crisis. We're at a point now where these the neoliberal urges in institutions and manifestations now have become public policy problems. It used to be, okay, I'm responsible for an institution and we make institutional decisions. Well, not anymore. The cost of higher education is so significant, it's now a public policy question. One of the things that David said, I do a lot of writing on the intersection of sport and society. And one of the things I've framed as a public policy issue and I've written about is the incredible public subsidization of intercollegiate athletics. Last year, USA data, I think, from 2013, just in Michigan alone, the amount of money that the people of Michigan subsidized Eastern Michigan, Central Michigan, and Western Michigan in football was $62 million. $62 million. $62 million. That is not an issue that you can say to the president of those three institutions and the athletic directors, it's your problem. This is a public policy issue. This is a public policy issue. Okay? I view this now as an institutional problem which afflicts all sectors, including public and nonprofits, universities being included. My definition here, and it's from writing I've done in LA Progressive, there's nothing there that will be of any anything new to you. We talked a lot at the conference about various aspects of social life in market terms, viewing success as a matter of personal achievement. And one of the things that I have really struggled with as a person who feels strongly about issues of the public good. We call it the common good at Michigan State. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but for the public good is this emphasis on private good and the extent to which it connects to the public good. And is there in fact an overbalance or overemphasis on private good, and to what extent does that have an impact on the public good? And the other thing that I think that I've really struggled with, and I'm sure a number of people in this room have struggled with it, if not all of you, is that coming from a community sociology background, working for years in community development, one of the precepts always is we engage together, we create together, we build together, collaboration, partnership. And one of the things that I began to notice in the mid-90s was we don't have open conversations. Decisions are made over here, okay, then they're promulgated. And I remember one time at a presentation, someone was invited in from the outside who said, the problem with you people is that you're not aligned. You don't have alignment. And someone from the audience says, what do you mean by that? Okay, the president says, provost basically tells the deans what's expected, the department chairs follow suit, and the faculty basically have to get in line. That's alignment. And that's why you're not as effective as you need to be. So this notion of organizing, the notion of connectivity, the notion of the sort of the metaphor of the table was replaced by, close the door, people who have titles and positions in the formal system basically make these decisions. I remember at Michigan State, we had open conversations, faculty task forces on virtually everything we did at Michigan State. If you recall Michigan Staters, the MSU idea, which was institutional diversity in action, we had task force on SPARC, which is what should intercollegiate athletics look like. Undergraduate, graduate, I chaired the outreach committee, gone. So we begin to focus on competition, return on investment, and so this pay scale metric, which I know, John, you're very familiar with in terms of evaluating institutions on return on investment. So what you can do is you parents can look at the pay scale data that basically says if you go to X college, what's that look like in terms of return on investment for the lifetime? And that is an indicator of something as it relates to higher education. So we're all familiar with that. But for me, what's interesting about it is that getting to where I am now is really a matter of serendipity. I had back surgery in November of 2013, soon after I retired, and I wanted to stay engaged intellectually, and so I just sort of stumbled into what we're going to be talking about today, and that is writing short essays, 600 to 1500 words, that I call public writing, on issues that are relevant, I think, for the conversation that we're having here. So it wasn't something that was deliberate, that was preordained. It's simply a number of things came together, converged, and here we are. And what I decided to do, even though I can reconstruct it now, this is more reconstructed logic than logic in use, is we live in Fort Myers, so I started submitting columns to the local press, which is very good. They publish, on average, 2 citizen-submitted guest commentaries each day. This was published just on Thursday, and the title of it is Amid the Madness, Getting a Square Deal for Players. And what I write about in this essay is basically that the NCAA and the large universities are making out like bandits. Last year, the NCAA's resources was close to $1 billion, and their quote-unquote profit was almost $100 million. And so the issue is, when we have issues in intercollegiate sports, head injuries, what's going to happen to these students? Are they really students? These are the kinds of things that I talk about. And I really have to give the news press, the Gannett paper in Fort Myers, a lot of credit, because I'm writing with an edge. I've written essays on what would it be like if Pope Francis and the approach he takes, if he were the CEO of your organization, how might it be different? And obviously it's a way of using his leadership style as a way to really deconstruct, I don't say neoliberal, but deconstruct what neoliberal leadership looked like. For example, to even raise questions about ourselves, that we can actually stand before a mirror rather than saying we're great, how can we be great, saying we've got some problems here, and how can we address those issues. And the other two, one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast, both by invitation because they had read my stuff. What I like about these two is that anybody can submit it. So it democratizes the expression. In fact, I'm working this weekend on 3 articles for the sports column that have been submitted by people around the country who have something to say. One, in fact, happens to be on head injuries in sports, and I like it a lot. So those are the reasons that it's there. And again, if you'd like a copy of this presentation, this is the URL for the two areas, East and West Coast publications where I've been writing for the public. And of course, the connection, which is very important to social media, particularly Twitter, is absolutely critical, much more than the Facebook. The major drivers for me in what I've been writing is that, and it's something I emphasize over and over again, the public, as I see it, is at risk. You are at risk. And I write about various issues and why I think the public is at risk. And one of the things that I try to emphasize, and I think having a background in community sociology, the work of Saul Alinsky and others, is one of the ways to communicate is just to say it. Don't let it be a little secret out there. And one of the things I focused on is slogans and marketing that is done by institutions that proclaims them to be excellent, exceptional, without problem, particularly in terms of comparing my institution, our institution, to another institution. We're better. So for example, one of the things I've written about, and you'll see a URL, is I've taken the Spartan Will campaign from Michigan State and really deconstructed it and framed it as a profound expression of exceptionalism wrapped within a neoliberal ethic. This notion, when you pull your car in, it says, raise the bar, Spartans. If we don't raise it, who will? My response is, faculty at universities all over the world, if we don't do it, they will. And the question then becomes, what are we doing that is different from, better than, other faculty members? The question is, those questions are never answered. But you have the assertion of exceptionalism wrapped within this neoliberal ethic that basically forces you to say, is that true? Or the other alternative is you just accept it. And I'm going to give some more examples. A great book that Richard Bawden, a colleague of ours, recommended a number of years ago is The University in Ruins. And one of the points that the author of that book says is that universities are in ruins because what they do is they use the word excellence in a very glib way, using language. But the question is, what does excellence truly mean? So when we use phrases like MSU is committed to the common good, the question really screams, what do you mean by common good? That's really important. And what does excellence mean in relationship to contributing to the public good? So what I've seen and experienced was an incredible increase in marketing and communication specialists to the point that their presence is ubiquitous. And I've come to the conclusions that this marketing and communications is now seems to be equivalent to public and community relations, sort of the outreach from the university to the community, and it's sort of like way in which we frame it. And also what's happened is that presidents, deans, provosts are now field marshals with an army of affiliates. We've all seen the numbers in terms of the rise of the administrative numbers at universities in relationship to what's happening with the tenured faculty members. And what I've really struggled with, and again, coming from a background as a sociologist, rural sociologist with a focus on community development, as David well knows, not only here but around the world, where you focus on the public good. We are here to enhance the public good. Now what I began to experience starting in the mid-90s was the lead foot really is what's best for the institution. What's best for the institution, not what's best for out there. Now I'm not suggesting that it was this way before and it's this way now. It's always a matter of degree, but it's gotten to the point, I think, and the way I experienced this neoliberal crisis, I think we've gotten so far now that we're in a crisis stage with too much emphasis on the institutional good and an underemphasis on the public good. Primary targets, money, and what I experienced at Michigan State I think is similar. It's not getting the money from external sources. Now it's what are those external sources? For example, for years and years and years in our college, faculty would, and they still do, secure resources from USDA, USAID, but those sources are very different from NIH, NSF, and it's very clear what's preferred. And those of you who follow what the machinations of higher education know what happened to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln with respect to AAU membership. And one of the reasons was too much ag research and not, quote unquote, peer-reviewed high-impact work. And this emphasis on a better institution is a growing institution. A better institution has more growth. There are more notches in the gun belt. There are more buildings, more money coming in from donors. And I don't want to be naive about this, but the question of, okay, is growth really an indicator of excellence and quality? And one of the things, again, that I found so interesting is, can we talk about it? Can we have a conversation about it? And one of the things we know, and it was brought up yesterday, is one of the aspects, dimensions of the neoliberal regime is we don't want to raise questions. We've got too much work to do. And so we don't talk about it. And one of the things I noticed as my career evolved here was so much more was put on the laps of administrators and faculty members, there wasn't time to have, you couldn't raise any questions. I served on the advisory committee of the Associate Provost for Academic Human Resources, and one of the last meetings before I retired was, if we keep on asking department chairs to do all this stuff in the name of the institution, when are they going to have time to lead? It's all management stuff. It was a new I to dot, a new T to cross, a new this, a new that, a new, and I say, there's no time to do anything. So you get into this process of having to continue to deliver the goods within this regime, and there's no time to do anything else. And the other thing that I noticed was the comparisons are made to other institutions. And I've written about this. I was a major actor in the engagement movement in higher education back in the 90s. To see how that has evolved over the last 20 years just breaks my heart, because we now focus on issues of, okay, how many dollars did you bring in for outreach and engagement? How many publications? How many faculty involved? When you look at Ernest Boyer and what he was writing about in the early 90s, that was not what was driving it. He was writing about the great American college and what it looked like in relationship to the partnership to the betterment of cities, the world, not whether or not we can put a graph up that shows that we've had a 3% growth in the number of faculty members involved in engagement. That's not what it was. But again, this neoliberal institutionalization leads to those kinds of things. So I want to give an example here. We're going to see if it's going to work. Of the gibberish that occurs that needs to be looked at and said, what? Portland State for years, with Judith Romali's leadership, was one of the leaders in the engagement movement. We are the University of the Portland region, and it was an expectation all faculty would engage, right, John? Okay, now with new leadership, the tagline is fearless. First of all, I want some of the, I mean, it's frank fear. I want to get some of the action. In fact, I would say fear more, not fear less. University of Maryland has, their tagline is fearless ideas. And I love this when you take, when you anthropomorphize. So you take ideas and bring a human quality to an idea. At any rate, Portland's idea, we are fearless. Okay, so I said, well, I wonder what that means. I want to go, here are fearless facts. We have more than 200 degree programs. Okay, is there a line? 150, you're fearful. 200, you're fearless. We have the nation's only urban honors college. Okay, we have advisors. That's great. We have resource centers. And what I love, the one I love the most, we have a rec center and an outdoor program that is second to none in the state. What I find amazing about this, and I know I'm on tape, anybody with any sort of IQ that is beyond being an imbecile can't look at those fearless facts and connect it to a tagline, we are fearless, or fearless success. We graduated a football player who played in the NFL. This is crazy. This does not make any sense whatsoever. And I don't mean to point a finger at Portland State, other than to say it's concrete, I'm not making this up. But what's amazing to me, and this is what I try to do with the public, is you have to judge. This is the mirror. You judge it. Now, if you're fine with this, you know, what am I going to do? Come to your house and say you're nuts? No. What I'm going to say is, let's look at this. And then you be a judge as to whether or not this makes any sense. To me, it's nonsense. But you be the judge. Okay, let me see if I can get out of this. I think I can do this. We'll go back here. This is very interesting here, another one. There was a very interesting article in the Washington Post last week by George Mason on George Mason University students. And the reason I like the article is that it made so much sense to me. These were undergraduate students who actually, in fact, what I can do if this is working the way it should work, It should come up now. Yeah. So this is a story about GMU undergraduate students who have found that bass, the sound of bass, if calibrated correctly, can be used to extinguish fires. Really innovative. That actually sound waves can be used to it. Now, what's interesting about this story, it's from the Washington Post, it's not from George Mason University, is embedded in the article is these students who had these, they were together one night in a dorm room and started talking about their high school science classes. And they started bouncing around these ideas. So they start going to faculty and the faculty say, no, you're nuts. This isn't going to work. I'm not going to work with you. I mean, it is logic in use. You see that all the time. An idea that's outside of the margins, you go to an expert and the expert says, nah. They were skeptical. And then one faculty member said, well, let's see what happens, and worked with the students, and eventually what they have. And now you've got, they've been featured, and they're getting all kinds of positive ideas or coverage because of what they've done. Now let's contrast that to a message from a university source. I don't want to identify the name of the institution. Now what's interesting about this example, and I've done this in my writing, what I'll do is I will present something like this, just present it the way it is, and then we'll analyze it. For example, last year, John, you may know Patrick Harper, who's president of the University of Delaware, does that name ring a bell at all, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, basically lambasting the effort of athletes who are organizing with respect to greater compensation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what I did was I took the letter that was in the New York Times and then basically looking at it from an Alinsky-type community organizer, just deconstructed it. And it was just, I couldn't even believe what was written because a lot of it was assertions that were unfounded, declarations made that really the bottom line was, trust me, I'm an authority figure. Statements made that if this happens, then this, which is draconian, will follow it, which you say to yourself, what are the odds of that happening? But look at this. Classic example of taking something that is true, that you can verify in fact, with something that needs to be critiqued. So, name of person, big name person, a former player at the school, stopped by the school and went to the team room before the team played to say a few words of support. Do you think that happened?
Sure.
Does it happen a lot? It happens a lot. Players come back. It happens at Iowa State. They come back, you know. Oh my God, he was a great player. Guys do this and so. Next part. Caring about this year's team is what makes name of school truly special. Well, if in fact something happens all the time, why would it be truly special for this to happen at this school? And again, it's exceptionalism. So what you have here, I think, is a, and this was from the Facebook official site from the school's athletic media department. One of the things that I found very interesting is the difference, and again, I have not done a study of this, but I tend to sense a difference when the athletic department's media people report to a university vice president, not in athletics, vis-a-vis when the athletic media people report to the athletic director. And this is just anecdotal. My casual observation is you're more likely to get this if it goes through the athletic director's office versus if it goes through a VP who's not associated with the athletic director. There's really nothing at all, from my perspective, that makes this school truly special, because it happens all the time. Alums come back and they come back. That's what they do. Okay? What's interesting about all of this, because this is where I think the public is at risk, because in this neoliberal environment, you try to get ahead of the curve by communicating, declaring what is and what isn't with emphasis so that you can influence people's opinions and understanding, whatever it is you're talking about. But I like this quote from Andrew DeBlanco's book on college, what it was, is, and what it should be. And DeBlanco is a Columbia University humanist. And his argument is one of the fundamental purposes of higher education is this. All of us are bombarded with pleadings and persuasions of which many are distortions and deceptions, ads, political appeals, punditry of all sorts. Some say health examples. Some say health care reform will bankrupt the country. Others say it is an overdue act. But any list we might have could be extended indefinitely, infinitely, indefinitely, with conflicting claims between which citizens must choose or somehow mediate. So it'd be obvious that the best chance we have, this is the important part of this, to maintain a functioning democracy, it is a citizenry that can tell the difference between demagoguery and responsible arguments. And if you think about that is fundamental to what college needs to be about. And it's one of the areas in which liberal arts colleges, and one of the points he makes, I don't know if it's true or not, is that you could get all of the undergraduate students in the United States who are enrolled in liberal arts colleges, you could get that, they could fit in Michigan Stadium, the football stadium. Think about that. Think about that. Anyway, so I'll go through this quickly. This will give you an idea of the commentaries I've been writing. A lot of it is socio-historical with an issue. The first two are the ones that I've done. Most of the literature review I've done on neoliberalism are in those. I've taken a Cole Porter song written in 1936. I've Got You Under My Skin. Cole Porter was a very interesting person, highly addicted to drugs, sex, all kinds of things. And I've taken those lyrics and applied it to what I consider to be one of the biggest challenges we're facing in this country, and that's addiction with sports. We're addicted to it. We're fanatics. And so I've taken a love song, I've Got You Under My Skin, and I've applied it to an analysis or critique of big-time athletics. I really enjoy doing that. And then What Happened to Higher Education? And the another one there that I think is of relevance is this my analysis of what does it mean, what does exceptionalism mean, and I apply it specifically to higher education. So look at exceptionalism again, wrapped within the fabric or wrapped in neoliberalism, and applied it to higher education. And I will say this, and I will say it on tape, if Betty has, and I've sent this to the president's office. I include Spartan Will in that criticism, and it is a criticism. I'm very concerned about making proclamations about excellence and being exceptional that really does not stand any test of validity. I mean, it is an assertion of being exceptional that cannot be defended. And then another example is I've done a lot of work on, okay, I know it's important for sports teams to win games in sports. What does it mean to be socially responsible? So you can look to a place like Boston University that doesn't have a football team, college football team, that is probably the leading institution in the country with respect to looking at head injuries in sports. But then the question I would raise, what portion of the NCAA budget is being devoted to, I mean, we are research institutions for Pete's sake, on head injuries? To what extent are we exploring issues like long-term health care for athletes? We basically just say, okay, we bring them in, they play, next. The other day, and the reason I was inspired by this, I was watching television the other night, watching basketball games, and I did some channel switching, as we all do, and I noticed, and I focused on the Big Ten, okay? Social responsibility. We have 14 schools, I think, I didn't check the morning paper in the Big Ten, or maybe 15. We have 14 schools in the Big Ten, okay? Socially responsible. The majority, vast majority of players in both football and basketball are African Americans, right? And if you look at the players on the floor any one time, last night I was watching, who was Louisville playing? Louisville was playing, I can't remember who they were playing.
NC State.
And for most of the second half, 10 African Americans. In the Big Ten. How many African-American head basketball coaches do we have? Number, please. Denominator is 14. At Rutgers, which wasn't in the Big Ten. So before Rutgers came in, zero. How many football coaches do we have in the Big Ten, African-Americans? Majority African-American football players. How many?
Zero.
I don't know anything about.
One. Well, all you need to know is a socially responsible institutions can't afford to have a disconnect between the frontline players, frontline workers, who are predominantly African-Americans, without providing not even close to equal access for African-American administrators. Athletic directors, football coaches. So what does that say? And again, rather than saying I have the answer, the issue is, here's a mirror. Does this make sense? I don't think so. I think in a society like ours, that just simply makes no sense. So when I talk about social responsibility, what I say is, winning is not enough. Winning is not enough. And I also would say the insatiable appetite of collegiate sports for more money, more money, more money, more money. What I've learned is you need more money. For example, at Michigan State, where our defensive coordinator now is an endowed position. It's an endowed position. Somebody put $3 million on the line. So if you're a professor and you just haven't published enough, go into football, focus on defense, and you can say, I'm an endowed defensive coordinator. I said this to a friend the other day over lunch. God bless him, who's 94, and he said, well, it's another Frank Fears bullshit. That can't be true. It's just bizarre. It's true. It's true. It's true. So let me bring this to a close by saying we're all, I think, a function of the experiences we went through, and I will say this emphatically before I go through this, is that I took for granted, just saying you said earlier, Bonnie, I took for granted things were the way they were always going to be the way they were. Because I went through the 60s with all these kinds of things, the Great Society, the March on Washington, all the things that brought people together. And it was not, and we know this from looking at history, it was a time that was very yeasty. If you think about what happened in the South, think about what happened in Alabama and Mississippi and so on. But it was a focus on social issues, the establishment of the Peace Corps. And then we had the 70s, where there's a significant amount of disruption, Watergate, the Iranian hostage-taking, Nixon resigning because of Watergate, runaway inflation. And what happened was, by the time the 80s picked up, particularly with Ronald Reagan, whom I made a presentation to a leadership group a couple weeks ago, and I said, Ronald Reagan to me is the most important political figure in this country in the last 40 years. And the reason is, it was the beginning of the dismantling of the progressive, going back to FDR, started in the 80s, wrapped in very positive, you know, if you look at the, taken from his inaugural address, using language that lifts us up, but a very different way. You know, when the Thousand Points of Light initiative came with Bush, it was uplifting in one way, but it was also a very, very significant recalibration, a reconceptualization of the purpose and function of government. And there were widespread institutional adjustments, and one of the famous quotes from who was a Confederate in this process, of Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. And that we began to see the rise of neoliberalism across, certainly in the public sector, to the point that, and when David was introducing me, I was CEO of the Lansing Food Bank. Of all the places where I didn't think this neoliberal way of thinking and acting would affect is the nonprofit sector, to the point now that I mean, Kathy and I watch very carefully what we give, how much, to whom, and for what purpose. And one of the things that I found myself saying, how can you do this? But I have been raising serious questions about nonprofits in terms of the question is, to what extent is a nonprofit truly dedicated to serving the public good? Because what you've seen is the diminishment of citizen action within the context of the nonprofit sector, and what it's, and Theda Skocpol at Harvard and others have written about this, you now have a highly professionalized, institutionalized career ladder where volunteers, the citizens, basically give time and money. And you think about how that relates to what she writes about in terms of citizens' associations back in the 20s and 30s and so on. It's amazing. So the question is, okay, now we have these inwardly focused institutions and organizations. We have unbridled branding, protect the brand, which, you know, was probably one of the issues, certainly in the Penn State debacle. Very sad situation. Strong emphasis on exceptionalism across sectors. And we have all these examples from the GM ignition switch, very inward, protect GM, the church scandal in the Roman Catholic Church, and we're Roman Catholics, what happened at Penn State, what happened at the VA, all the nonprofit fundraising scams. You know, one of the things I don't want to do is to basically say, you know, I hurt my foot the other day and that was caused by neoliberalism. I mean, you can't wrap everything under neoliberalism, but there's enough to say it's a societal thematic that is so, it's so in the water, in the air, that it's, you have to say to yourself, it's getting more and more difficult to say, wait a minute, let's step back now. Is this what you, the way you really want it? And the biggest issue for me is this, as I said earlier, is, you know, I'm not naive. There, you will serve partisan ends. I mean, if you're CEO of anything, it has to be about the institution. But how does that balance with serving and advancing the public good? So I've applied this to public higher education in an article that I wrote for the Public called "What Happened to Higher Education?" And what I basically said is, let's look at public higher ed as both a social institution, but also as an industry. So let me read this. Public institutions serve the public good and they compete for resources, clients, and competitive standing. Therein lies a major challenge, to be true to social obligations and to run institutions as a business. The business side, the competitive side, can take precedence, thereby diminishing social mission. That happens when an institution focuses too much attention on advantaging itself as it competes. Success often gets measured in organizational, not in public terms, which can displace mission-related obligations. And what's very interesting, and this I have a citation here, the Harvard Institute for Public Innovation did a national study where they asked CEOs across sectors to talk about their priorities. And what they came up with was, the authors came up with this label, the organization first approach, because it was not easy for them to find CEOs who could talk about outside in. It was always, for the most part, that's too strong, wasn't always, but predominantly inside out, the organization first. A very, very good study that's sobering. So we need to run higher education as a business. That's an assertion. I don't think anybody would quibble with that, but I think it's reasonable at the very least. But the question we don't ask enough is, what business are we in? So what I've written is, balance for higher education is achieved when the assertion, which comes from the industry side, and the question from a social institution side are considered equally and acted on simultaneously. Approaching things that befits higher education's historic underpinning as a social institution and enhances its viability in today's world, which is highly competitive as an industry. The biggest difference that I've experienced from the time I was mentored in higher education was many of the people that mentored me, George Beal, Jerry Clonlin, Ron Powers, those are real people who socialized me into what I needed to be as a sociologist at Iowa State. They were very much on the social institution side. And what I experienced over the last 15 years is the predominance of people around the table on the industry side. And to be very blunt about it, I wasn't good at the table, really didn't want to be at the table, and I finally said, enough is enough. There's also another person who's writing for the Public, Frank Bruni. Some of you may read his columns in the New York Times. Although our lurch from one crisis to the next in this country often obscures all other matters, one of the most important issues in American life right now is higher education's identity crisis. It's soul-searching about what it should accomplish, whom it should serve, and how it must or mustn't be tweaked. And the biggest thing I'm concerned about, is that higher education probably was always in crisis, but now we're really in crisis. And what we have is the field generals are neoliberals for the most part. So the future fixing of it is going to be in the hands of the people who, for the most part, contributed significantly to the problems we face. That is frightening to me. If I could go back in time and say, okay, George Beall, Jerry Conlon, Ron Powers, now, you're handed this, you didn't have anything to do with it, but here, I'd feel a lot more comfortable about what the outcome would be, Jan. So what's our role in all of this? If we look at people in history who achieved things, they had objective and externally true standards of justice and injustice. They were indignant when those external standards were violated. They subscribed to moral systems, whether secular or religious, that recommended specific ways of being and had specific structures of what is right and wrong and had specific disciplines about how you might get better over time, from David Brooks. What does that mean in terms of flying this plane down to the tarmac now? We need people in higher education. We need people in all kinds of institutions that do what Robert Huttner wrote about recently in the Huffington Post. We need radicals because drastic change against entrenched and concentrated power requires personal bravery to the point of obsession. It requires a radical sensibility to look beyond today's limits and imagine what seems sheer impossibility within the current social order. An example, the College Athletes' Rights and Empowerment Faculty Coalition, a number of colleagues listed there with their pictures, and there are two faculty members just retired from MSU in the College of Law, Robert and Amy McCormick, and they are leading scholars in the country looking at basic labor law as it relates to revenue-producing athletes. What they have found, in their research is that when you look at what these revenue-producing athletes, basketball and football, when you look at their roles and responsibilities, then you take a random sample of other university employees and look at their roles and responsibilities, their argument is that it's baseless. The student-athlete moniker is baseless. These people are employees and should be treated as employees. And what we have, and they've been very firm. They wrote a paper several years ago, and the title is the New American Apartheid, in terms of referring to what's happening in intercollegiate sports. And the reason I bring up intercollegiate sports over and over again, I write about it, is that it is of probably all the things we do in higher education, the most public, that people can relate to. And again, showing that mirror. So basically what they've done, this is a coalition from around the country. The gentleman in the upper left is a faculty member at the University of South Carolina. The woman on the bottom right is a faculty member at Drexel. The fellow in the upper right, you may, if you watch ESPN, he's an adjunct faculty member, I think, at Maryland, who is also a regular on ESPN and writes a column in Texas, I think, in Dallas, at really taking on the NCAA from the perspective of what is socially responsible, and that takes courage. But that approach, and you can see here why they're doing this, concussions, mentioned before, the number of African Americans in leadership positions. A very interesting study down here that was published in The Atlantic about a year ago that looked at all the football teams that were in the bowl games and looked at the graduation rates for African Americans. And what was very interesting is that the school that won the national championship that year, Florida State, of those schools, which school do you think had the lowest graduation rate for African Americans? Florida State. The school that won the national championship had the lowest graduation rate for African Americans. And you know, the NCAA uses a very liberal approach to graduation. 6 years. From the time you come in, 6 years is how it's measured. So it's not like 4 years, it's 6 years. So Stanford, no surprise, was number one in this analysis. What's also very interesting about this is who is writing this, because obviously I'm just a small group that is doing this. Let me see if I can get to this. What you find is a number of the people who are doing this writing are women, people of color. Dave Zirin, who is at The Nation does an excellent job of talking about International Olympic Committee and other issues. We have Christine Brennan, who does an excellent job at USA Today. Leonard Pitts, who's my favorite columnist, at, he's nationally syndicated at the Miami Herald. Of course, our friend Giroux, who's been writing for, forever on these things. But you find even in sports, you find some of the best social commentary being written by women and people of color, not by males. So let me do one couple more things and I'll be done. The radical approach is certainly one way. I found this book to be very, very useful, and I've used it communicated with a number of my colleagues, written by Deborah Meyerson, not a recent book, about 15 years ago, that talks about tempered radicals, published by Harvard Business School, where she talks about and gives examples of how to bring about change in hostile environments, where you bring a sense of radicalism, but you also temper it so that you can live to talk about it. Your career is not lost. You don't end up being marginalized. You don't end up being at the margins, but you have an opportunity. And quite frankly, what I like about it is, if neoliberalism's one of the tenets is it's stealth-like,
this is too.
This is too. You know, if you think about what happened and why neoliberalism really got going is that the conservatives of the late 1960s saw what citizens were doing in the grassroots. And then what they did is they mirrored it. They started organizing for purposes of business, and why am I blanking on it? The big memo that was written, he became the Supreme Court judge. It's always linked as to be the, pardon?
Powell
memo. If you haven't had a chance to read the Powell memo, it's a manifesto written in, I think, in 1970 that basically says to conservatives around the country, you got to get your act together. We've got to organize just like the folks, and they were pissed at Nixon because they said Nixon is capitulating to these grassroots crazy people. We're going to have an EPA. Can you imagine? You know, so you can't trust Nixon, big liberal he was. You can't trust him. And what was interesting about Powell, he then later became, he was on the Supreme Court. So anyway, now to close it, so the contribution that I try to make for whatever it is to enhance public awareness. I try to get out two of these articles a week, 600 to 1200 words, understanding, hopefully for some at least, reflecting on what's being said, and perhaps at some point, people maybe raising some questions rather than accepting promulgations as fact. Being open, this is the tough one, and Kathy and I find this very, very interesting to say that, I could use another word, but I won't, with respect of working with alums. It's easy for alums to say, UMass sucks, and we don't want to be like UMass. But if you're an alum of Michigan State, UMass sucks. We can't say anything, even beginning to raise any questions. Critique is viewed as abject criticism. And loyalty is questioned. You know, you can't. So is it possible to begin to raise questions so that we begin to have a conversation about, is this the way we want it? And then if for some, taking action in some way that might be changed. So when I look back, way back, I look certainly at Jefferson's influence in higher education, but people who have had a significant role in the development of Michigan State, Holmes, a business person in Detroit, who the one that really had the idea for what now Michigan State University, and had to go toe-to-toe with Tappan, who was president of the University of Michigan, who didn't want a Michigan State. The vision of University of Michigan was, we'll be the agricultural school. Yeah, we'll be, that's true. And so he went, he was smart, he was shrewd, he worked the back doors of the legislature and got the allocation to start Michigan State University. And Williams was the first president. And Williams then worked with Morrill. Basically, Holmes was the Michigan guy. And even though Williams was the first president of Michigan State, he spent most of his time in D.C. In fact, died of a heart attack on one of his trips back to Michigan from from Washington, working with Morrill, that led to the Morrill Act and land-grant universities. And I went to, this is an Iowa State story. I was in Iraq in 2009 with a group of colleagues representing land-grant universities, and we were sitting with a number of university presidents from around Iraq. It was part of the idea of, let's see if we can better connect American universities with Iraqi universities, and I was the first one up. And I said, my name's Frank Fear, I'm Vice Dean of the College of Agriculture at Michigan State, and I'm very proud to say that Michigan State is the first land-grant university. Well, this person over here was from Iowa State, and the person over here was from Penn State. And I almost died. I mean, the two of them came at me hard because it is so contentious what the first land-grant university. Iowa State makes a claim, Kansas State makes a claim, Penn State makes a claim, even though Penn State was established as a high school. They make the claim. And then what's really amazing, West Virginia also makes the claim. I think they figured, what the hell, why don't we jump in? But Morrill was the one who started. And then John Hanna, who built Michigan State University. So thank you very much. I hope this was helpful, and I'll turn it back to you.